1-1. Okay. So we do have a war of the worldviews, do we not, folks? This is a war of the worldviews. It's a spiritual war, as the Apostle Paul says. And it is really in regard to creation science versus what I call evolutionism. I don't particularly like the word creationism. If there's an ism, it belongs with evolution, evolutionary naturalism, or evolutionism, as I love to say it. I had a radio debate with two Darwinists years ago, and I used the word evolutionism one too many times, and this guy came unglued and said, it's not evolutionism. But it truly is. And so this is a war of the world views. And all science is creation science. Would we agree with that this evening? All science is creation science. All truth is God's truth. And certainly science is the search for truth. You know, back when I was in high school in 19... I was taught that science was a search for truth. But of course, in this 21st century, they don't teach that anymore, do they? They don't teach that science is a search for truth. And of course, the question is, why don't they teach that science is a search for truth? Answer, because more and more in this secular society, the truth does not exist. Or the truth is relative. The truth is subjective. Hey man, what's true for you may not be true for me, okay, and we hear that all the time, but certainly, truth is does exist, and science is the search for truth. Science really is what we know to be true, mainly by the process of observation. We call that empirical science. So help me out again. Let's see now. All science is creation science. All truth is God's truth. Science is the search for truth. And then number four this evening, Jesus is the truth. John 14:6. Jesus saith unto him, I am a way. No, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except by me. And so those four points I like to share with audiences just to kind of get, you know, reading from the same page, as it were. And I said those four points in Arizona about 4 or 5 months ago. There was an atheist in the audience, and boy, he made a whole website against ICR and yours truly because of those four points. And he said, we cannot allow the young people in America to hear this sort of thing. Well, I agree. I think we should be allowing the young people of America to be hearing that sort of thing. All science is creation science, and all truth is God's truth. So this is a war of the worldview, and we'll continue to look at that as we look through. And Psalm 139, I think, is a good pivotal verse, verse 14, when we look at the wonders and the mysteries of the human body. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, said David. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. You know, I love this verse, and when I took embryology, I had this verse in the opening page of my embryology textbook. Of course, it wasn't printed there. I had to put it there myself. But it certainly shows that God is the author. He has knit us together in the womb. It really is just amazing, the construct of the human body. Well, the late, great Theodotus Dobzhansky, who was one of the editors, if you will, one of the authors of the synthetic theory, the idea of evolution through natural selection with the addition of mutations and population genetics and all. Dobzhansky was a theistic evolutionist. He did believe in a God. I'm not sure how much conviction he had in that. But Dobzhansky wrote a very infamous article, an American biology teacher, in the early 1970s, where he said these words that have been ringing through the decades, that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. We as creation scientists would say, however, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of good science. And where science, where observational science will take us. And so Dobzhansky has used this, other evolutionists since the demise of Dobzhansky has been using this phrase as a watch phrase for evolutionary naturalism ever since this article was published. Well, we're going to look at some of the human systems in our bodies tonight. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time. Would somebody please unplug that clock back there? Just go ahead and unplug it. Thank you very much. Well, anyway, I'm going to have to zip right along and share with you with some of the amazing, amazing features of the human body and see that it doesn't have anything to do with evolutionary naturalism, but everything to do with a great creator designer, as we saw in Psalm 139. Respiratory system, reproductive, digestive, immune system. Immune system is absolutely incredible. I suppose if I had to choose one system in the human body, it would have to be the immune system as being the most complex. A close runner-up would be the nervous system. But my field is a rather unsavory field, and I don't talk about it too much. I'm a parasitologist. In other words, I study parasites. See how easy biology is? Okay, so I study parasites, and you don't have to go to France to study parasites. Thank you. Okay. But I'm a parasitologist. I discovered a new species of parasite when I did my research on high-altitude swallows in the state of Colorado and shot about 33 of them. I had to get all sorts of permits. I had to get a local permit, state permit, national permit, interstellar permit, intergalactic permit, all these permits. The poor little tree swallows weren't even on the endangered list. They were after I got through, but... So I got these permits and shot all these tree swallows, and they were 100% infection rate. They were all infected with a potpourri of parasites. They were beautiful little birds, and yet they were just shot through, so to speak, with parasites. And so in my research, I found a new species of parasite. It was a nematode found in the coelom membrane of the stomach there. Now, what do you get to do when you discover a new creature? You get to name it, right? And so I'm a real romantic guy, and I decided to name it after my wife. I wanted to get her name into the biological journals, you know, for posterity. And so I went home and I said, "Sweetheart, you know, I found this new parasite. I'm going to name it after you." When I woke up, she really did. She said, "No, thank you," in so many words. And so I had to change the name, and I called it Acuaria coloradensis. Boring, but that's a name, and now it's in the Journal of Parasitology, and it's probably on, Journal of Parasitology is a peer-reviewed journal, it's probably on most of your coffee tables this evening, right? Right next to Reader's Digest, TV Guide, Journal of Parasitology, can't wait for the next edition and all, and so that's my field, but in order to be a good parasitologist, you have to really understand the immune system. How does our immune system battle this foreign protein called a parasite that invades our body? Such as the most devastating, debilitating parasitic disease in the world today is malaria. Over 2 million people die per year of malaria. It's just a very devastating disease. How does our immune system cope with this? How does it do battle? Same thing with sleeping sickness. Sleeping sickness, a very insidious disease in Africa, and then it has something very much like it in South America called Chagas disease. So the immune system really is quite a sophisticated system, and it shouts creation. Well, how many cells do we have in our body? 75, very good, 75 trillion cells, the last time I counted. And these cells are very, very sophisticated. Now, Darwin back in the 1850s didn't understand anything about the cell, except it was just kind of a globular little portion of protoplasm, and it kind of had a membrane around it, and that's all he knew. It had a dark staining center. But each cell is surrounded by what's called a bilipid plasma membrane. Now, I'm sorry to use some of these big words, but when we look at the 75 trillion cells in our body, we find that they're surrounded by this very, very specific, well-designed membrane. If all we had time for tonight, ladies and gentlemen, would be for me to describe this plasma membrane in detail, that would be evidence enough for creation. That would be evidence enough for creation, this plasma membrane. Critical cellular proteins are found within and without the membrane. Some of the proteins go halfway through, some go all the way through, and they act as little gatekeepers, allowing material to go into and out of your 75 trillion cells. And the plasma membrane itself is made up of two layers. That's why they call it a bilipid membrane. Two layers, they're sandwiched together, and then they have these protein molecules going through them. One of the best ways that I can give as an analogy for the plasma membrane is this stretchable wrap here. What do they call this, like saran wrap or whatever? Think about saran wrap and make it even thinner than the saran wrap that you see here this evening. And then divide the thinness of this saran wrap into two additional layers, or just cut it in half longitudinally. And then you'll begin to get an idea as to how thin the plasma membrane of your cells are, 75 trillion cells that make you up. And then with this thin plasma membrane, infinitely thinner than what we see here, you have hundreds of thousands and hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of holes with these protein molecules that are going through this plasma membrane, allowing the materials to be very selective, the membrane to be very selective as to what goes through into the cell and what leaves the cell. That's why researchers who research this plasma membrane call the plasma membrane alive. They actually say it's living. It's alive. Well, the plasma membrane is so complex, as I say, it's alive, and we can see these protein molecules here that go right between or right through this bilipid membrane, that membrane that is divided into two equal parts. One of my favorite things I used to teach at Pensacola Christian College is what's called the sodium pump, sodium-potassium pump. Sodium and potassium are elements that are very, very important to maintain our homeostasis, particularly if you do a lot of hard work or if you're a distance runner or whatever else. You need to take those sports drinks that have a lot of sodium, potassium. Don't buy those expensive sports drinks anymore. All you need to do is drink water, eat a bag of potato chips. It's a lot cheaper, and you get the same amount of sodium, but potassium, and everything else. So that's a free be here this evening. But the sodium-potassium pumps that you see here are extremely sophisticated. Do you see, for example, and I forgot to bring my pointer. I can't believe I did that. Jonathan, maybe you have a pointer or something, a laser? But here's the plasma membrane. Do you see it right there? The plasma membrane, very, very thin, and then going through this plasma membrane are that sodium-potassium pumps there. How many do you have in our body? We have trillions upon trillions and trillions of these sodium-potassium pumps. If a person is lying in a coma in a hospital, two-thirds of all the energy that they use would be to run these sodium potassium pumps to keep an equal certain amounts of sodium in and out. Thank you, Jonathan. He just beat you to it. Thank you, brother. And so here's that. Oh wow, green. That's great. Okay. And so here's the plasma membrane. Now the plasma membrane, when you look at it on edge, when you look at the edge of the saran wrap, that's what you're looking at. And then you put one of those sodium potassium pumps right into the edge there. Very, very sophisticated. Very detailed. Well, they're submicroscopic pumps is what they are. They pump a certain ratio of sodium into the cell and potassium out of the cell, and vice versa as well. We've been designed, there's the D word, I love that word. We have been designed with 1,000 sodium pumps per square micron. Per square micron. That's why I say we have trillions upon trillions of these sodium-potassium pumps in our 75 trillion cells. And the plasma membrane surface, the total number of sodium pumps for a small neuron, that is a nerve cell, is 1 million. 1 million in a typical nerve cell in, for example, your brain. And so very, very sophisticated. So this is an evolutionary conundrum. Does neo-Darwinism, that is a synthetic theory, this is what I was getting at when I talked about the infamous Dr. Dobzhansky and his being one of the architects of the synthetic theory, does neo-Darwinism describe in any form, shape, manner how one of these pumps could evolve through chance, time, and natural processes? How could you get something like a sodium-potassium pump that is so sophisticated, so detailed, how could you get something like that come about by genetic mistakes? What is a word that means genetic mistakes? It begins with the letter M. Mutations, right, mutations. Well, mutations, how can I say this? They ruin your whole day, okay? Mutations are bad. Mutations, no good. I, as a biologist taking biology classes, and Chris as well, Chris has had so many biology classes, all the time we read about mutations and how deleterious they are. One thing that we never heard was beneficial mutations. That's almost, well, beneficial mutations, that's an oxymoron, isn't it? It's like saying married bachelor. Jumbo shrimp. Microsoft Works. So you know, a beneficial mutation is not something that you would ever expect to see. And even one evolutionist said not too long ago, his name is Dr. Paul Ehrlich, and he said in his book on human evolution that a beneficial mutation would be like you would jam a screwdriver, these are his words, into a computer. And he said you wouldn't expect that to help the computer, but once in a while it would, and that would be his beneficial mutation. I'm going to talk about the faith of the evolutionist, talk about wishful thinking that something like that, I mean, we all know how complex computers are. My family and I just moved to Dallas. Let's see, we've been in Dallas 2 days. And we had some movers. I'm nice when I call them movers. They're really gorillas. And the guy grabbed my computer, just kind of trailing it along the ground almost, along the cement, and just kind of threw it into the garage. I couldn't believe it. So, anyway, computers obviously very, very delicate. How in the world could something like this come about by time and chance? One article I wrote for ICR a couple of years ago had to do with protein folding. We are making proteins hand over fist. As you sit here this evening, your cells are in the business, if I can use that word, of making all sorts of proteins, structural proteins. That's this dead stuff on top of our head called hair. This is all structural protein too, skin. And as you get older, the systems that help make your skin begin to break down. But when you're young, in your teens, of course, you're very, you know, firm and supple and all that. And I used to have my students at PCC hold their hand out and then just kind of pinch some skin up in there. And you can try that this evening. Let's all do that just to show the structural protein. Now, if you're young and if you try to pinch some skin up, it kind of hurts because, your protein molecules are very, very firm. And they keep the skin attached to your body quite well. But the older you get, you lose supple firmness, and you get more and more elasticity. So when you get old like me, you just grab a handful of skin and wrap it around your hand a few times and all that. And so that's the enzyme systems that are slowly breaking down. Enzymes, that's a second kind of protein we have. Those are called regulatory proteins. So you have structural proteins that make structural proteins for your body, and then you have regulatory proteins, enzymes. We've all heard of enzymes, haven't we? Enzymes that help reactions go very, very quickly at body temperature. And the enzymes, there's nothing left to chance when you build an enzyme. As you are making enzymes right now, some enzymes are made in seconds. Some enzymes are so complex. How complex are they? They're so complex that it takes several minutes to make some enzymes with various kinds of what we call regulatory type functions and all. But the point is that through this process of protein folding, you've got to have all of the amino acids folding together in such a way that you get a functional protein. Nothing can be left to chance. And as Stryer, the biochemistry author of the text that I used in college, he said it's one of the most challenging and important areas of inquiry in biochemistry. Certainly it is challenging. It's challenging for the evolutionist. How can you ever explain protein folding through time and chance and natural processes? There's just too much detail there to allow something like chance to allow the folding of protein. Some of the most devastating diseases that people have is due to incorrect protein folding. You've got to get it right the first time. It's absolutely amazing, said Stryer, the complexity of the problem and the simplicity with which the body does it every day. That wasn't Stryer said that. It was this person, an IBM researcher, okay? And so it really is quite sophisticated as to how this occurs. Incorrectly folded proteins result in some of the most distressing human diseases, and, quote, errors of this process generate misfolded structures and can be what? Can be lethal, right? It can be lethal. So you've got to get it right the first time. Our brain, well, as I said, our immune system is probably the most sophisticated and detailed. When I was in Southern California, ICR paid me to take a class in immunology. It's called Advanced Vertebrate Immunology. It's been about 5 years now. One of the hardest classes I ever took. But a close second to the complexity of the immune system, as I said, is the nervous system, starting with our 3-pound brain. 3-pound brain between your ears. As one evolutionist said 20 years ago, is the most sophisticated concentration of matter in the universe. our 3-pound brain. Designed man with 100 billion neurons, that is brain cells, each is connected to at least 10,000 other neurons, giving well over 500 trillion connections in the brain. Again, we have to ask the question, does time, chance, and natural processes like random mutations, does that address how these 500 trillion connections in the brain would come about? Of course not. Of course not. It takes design. And design means a designer. Creation means a... And if things look like they've been designed by an architecturally designed, there might be an architect. And if the solar system looks tailor-made, there might be a tailor. See how that works? The brain is a swarm of cells in which everything is seemingly connected to everything else. The connections, though, follow a plan, an order. And this individual said this just back in 1987. And I use this quote this evening because I like the phrase he uses. It's a swarm of cells, but the connections betwixt these cells are so, so specific. But wait. There's more. You know, who's that guy on TV does that? Billy Mays! He shouts through the whole infomercial, but wait, if you call now in 15 minutes, we'll include 30 yogurt squirters, whatever he says. But wait, there's more. The average number of glial cells. Now, if you take histology, you know, glial cells are what we call sustentacular cells. Glial cells help to support the neurons of the brain. So unfortunately, when people get brain cancer, it has nothing to do with the actual brain cells. It's these glial cells, these support cells that undergo the prolific regeneration and so forth and cause the tumor formation. But the average number of these glial cells, for example, astrocytes, there's two different kinds of astrocytes, in the brain is 10 to 50 times the number of neurons. So you have a lot of these support cells called astrocytes that help to support the neurons and their activities. Very, very extremely sophisticated. The cerebral cortex, that's that layer, that very thin layer that is that you, when you look at a brain and you see those ridges, those convolutions, what you're doing really is just looking down upon the cerebral cortex. That's the active part of the brain. The total number of neurons is 20 billion, with the total number of synapses, that is the connection between the neurons, at about 240 trillion. 240 trillion. The cerebral cortex is only about 1.5 to perhaps 4.5 millimeters thick. So it's very, very thin, as it were, portion of very active brain neurological tissue. And the total number of sodium pumps, you remember I talked about those sodium pumps, for a small neuron, again, is about 1 million. Well, one evolutionist wanted to address the evolution of the brain, and certainly they don't believe in creation, they don't believe in the Bible account of our origins, and so they have to have an alternative explanation as to the origin of, like, the most sophisticated 3 pounds in the universe. And so this individual said, while recognizing that much is unknown or only imperfectly known, and I would say a hearty amen to that, he said, I have been able to unfold the fascinating story of hominid evolution of the human brain using what? That is a keeper of a quote, folks. Creative imagination. Can you imagine what would happen if years ago Henry Morris were to write in one of his books, well, you know, we can't answer this question biblically, but if we use our creative imagination, do you suppose the evolutionists would have taken us to task? Shake your head like this. Yes. And so I was really amused that John Eccles in 1989, not too awfully long ago, would appeal to creative imagination. Then he says, restrained by rational criticism. Oh, well, that's important, yes. I mean, so not only is he appealing to imagination, but no. You've got to have creative imagination in order to describe the so-called evolution of the human brain. There certainly are differences in man and chimpanzee when it comes to brain neurological functions and so forth. As one evolutionist said not too awfully long ago, striking differences in morphology, that is the shape, the actual physical shape of the brain, and cognitive abilities, that is the ability of the person or the chimp to make decisions or whatever, exist between humans and their closest evolutionary relatives, the chimpanzees. So there's vast differences, this individual is saying. And of course, we would expect that on the basis of the creation model. Well, one of my favorite portions of the human brain is something called the hypothalamus. And I would have my students more often than not write an essay about the hypothalamus during their final exam on human anatomy and physiology. It's only about the size of the tip of your thumb, and it only weighs about 4 grams. That's about 4 multivitamin pills. And yet, it is one of the most important bits of neurological tissue of your brain, the hypothalamus. It operates, it does so much. It regulates homeostasis. Now, homeostasis, it's kind of a big word, but basically it means the ability of all 11 systems in your body to work together in harmony. So you can sit here and kind of take in the information, drive a car, run a marathon, or whatever else. You need to have all systems working in harmony, working together. That's what they call homeostasis. And that's what your hypothalamus is designed by the Creator to do. As well as thirst, body temp, water balance, hunger, BP, all of that has to do with this, just this little bit of tissue the size of the tip of your thumb. And it links the endocrine system with the nervous system. And the endocrine system and nervous system, they complement each other so well. The nervous system is designed to work very, very quickly. Put your hand on a hot stove, yaha, pull a hand away immediately. But the endocrine system operates over weeks, months, perhaps even years. But they're linked together. Well, how about the ability to smell, olfactory? Human olfactory receptors, we have about 40 million of them. And so you smell that pizza or whatever else, and those are the olfactory cells firing off and sending a neurological input up to the brain, and you start salivating. You know, Pavlov's dog, does that ring a bell? But anyway, I was salivating and all. How many olfactory receptors do you think a puppy dog has? Think of these dogs with a long muzzle and all that. So if people have about 40 million, any guesses? It's just us here this evening. So 300 million? Pretty good. How about 1 billion? So dogs, and that's why they send these bloodhounds out to look for the convicts or whatever else, because they're using the 1 billion receptors to track things down there. So yeah, dogs are designed by the Creator to have excellent, excellent olfactory reception. Well, one of my favorite areas of human anatomy is vision. Vision. There's over 10 million rod and cone cells in the retina of our eye. Somebody have a dime? I think I have a dime. Usually I have to ask the audience because, you know, my wife gives me allowance and I always spend it right away. But anyway, dime, how thin is the edge of a dime? Anybody want to guess? It's about 1 millimeter. Yeah, a brand new dime is about 1 millimeter. And as it gets through the years, it gets a little less, obviously. But the dime on its edge is about 1 millimeter. If you cut the dime in half lengthwise, that's the thinness of your retina. And your retina is where everything happens. All this photon energy coming at us, going through the vitreous humor of our eye, is striking this 1/2 millimeter retina containing the 10 million rod and cone cells, and it rings a bell, basically. It takes all this information and processes it and sends it down through the, what nerve do they call that from the retina? Optic nerve. Now, anatomists and physiologists who study the human eye are coming to the conclusion, not only the human eye, but the vertebrate eye, that the optic nerve is really an extension of the brain. It's an extension of the brain. And so these 10 million rod and cone cells are packed together with a density of a 200,000 per square millimeter in the sensitive fovea centralis. And I won't get into that anymore, but it's a very, very sensitive area. Each of these minute photoreceptor cells is vastly more complex than our most sophisticated computer. I'm not exaggerating. Each one of these photoreceptor cells is unbelievable in its complexity and how rapidly the biochemical reactions occur to send a very specific nerve impulse transmission down through the optic nerve. So the retina has about 10 billion calculations that occur every second. So as you take in this information around you, as these photons, these units of light, are striking your retina, 10 billion calculations occur every second before the retina in the retina before the image, this is kind of messed up a little bit here, but there's a lot of neurological activity that is occurring there. And as you can see in the back of the diagram there, the rest of my text is, and so I'd have to work on that a little bit. So to stimulate 10 milliseconds of the complete processing of even a single nerve cell from the retina, get that. Now, 10 milliseconds. In other words, you take 1 second. Let's say this is 1 second. And you divide that second up into milliseconds, and you take 10 milliseconds. So that's just, what, that's less than a blink of an eye. 10 milliseconds of the complete processing of even a single nerve cell from the retina would require the solution of about 500 simultaneous, nonlinear differential equations 100 times, and it would take at least several minutes of processing time on a Cray supercomputer. You can tell the slide is a little old. You know, Cray supercomputers now kind of are dinosaurs. They've gone by the board. But I'm not sure what's taken place of Cray supercomputers anymore. But certainly there's a lot of very sophisticated supercomputers out there. But the ability of just one of these photoreceptors to process all this information is unbelievably fast. Again, I have to ask the question tonight, ladies and gentlemen, can we attribute that kind of sophistication to time, chance, and natural processes? Genetic mistakes? Natural selection? I think not. I think not. So here is the very, very important fovea centralis right here, and here is what they look at when they look at your retina, and it's only about a half a millimeter in thinness, but a lot of activity is going on. So a photon is a single unit of light. The amount of light necessary to excite a cone cell, remember our retinas are made up of rod cells and cone cells, the amount of light necessary to excite a cone cell is about 100 photons. How much light, in terms of the units of light that are mentioned there, how much light is necessary to excite a rod cell? If it takes maybe 100 photons to excite a cone cell, how much for a rod cell? Anybody want to guess? 10 billion? Okay, that's a good one. One. One photon is all it takes. That's incredibly sensitive. That's beyond sensitive. I don't know what any adjective that would go beyond that. But that's acutely sensitive that a single photon of light, what we can measure as a unit of light, would be enough to kick in what we call in biology an action potential that rings a bell up in the brain that something is going on there. So the bottom line is, how did the eye evolve? That's a good question to ask this evening. How did the eye evolve? We're beginning to know something about the scientific mechanism involved in signal processing of three-dimensional color vision in real time. That's what's going on right now as you sit here. You're getting three-dimensional color vision in real time through color processing. But evolutionists are no closer to a scientific explanation of how the eye evolved than Darwin had in the 1860s. Still, they're clueless. Scientific American magazine about 4 years ago had an article where the author admitted, to his credit, I salute him, he said, we can only explain about half of what's going on in terms of the cellular activity of the retina. They can only explain about half. And that was in the 21st century when he said that. We're still a long, long way to go, ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to the actual processing of what the eye does. Well, that's enough about the eye. I think the eyes have it, don't you? I think they really have an incredible, show the ability of the creator, the actual creator's handiwork when it comes to anatomy and physiology. Well, let's do some experiments tonight, kind of wake people up here, and this is what I did at Pensacola. Let's do this. Put your hand up and take your thumb and push your thumb down and see if you can touch your arm here. I have three daughters, and they have no problem. They just take their whole hand, and they shove their thumb down. It goes right up against their arm. And this is as far as I can get right here. I can't tell you what pain I'm experiencing right now as I I do that. I would say that more women are able to do that than guys. And it just kind of shows the ability of the joints to have a kind of a plasticity and all. And so there's all sorts of things that we can do to show how much latitude there is when it comes to joint movement and all, but that's one of my favorite ones. How about the swallow reflex? Now, swallowing is very important because we have a portion of our pharynx which is involved both with the transmission of air as well as food, and so it's not good to talk at the same time as you're swallowing, and we've all experienced that, and we become social outcasts for a minute or two as we do some reverse peristalsis and so certainly it's very important that when we have a common, a freeway, as it were, for air water and food, that we know when to swallow and when not to. And so let's do this. I want to show you that there's a section in your brain, and I won't show it to you, but there's a section in your brain which actually does it's like resetting a switch. When a fuse blows, you can reset it, can't you? And there's actually a switch in your brain, if I can use the word switch, that resets your swallow reflex, okay? So what I'm trying to get at is this. Every time I clap my hands, I want you to just swallow, okay? So I'll clap my hands once, and then you swallow. And so every time you hear my hands clap, don't swallow yet. Every time you hear my hands, I saw somebody. Okay. Every time I do that, you swallow, okay? Easy. Well, you can tell that, you know, I see people going, you know, they take me too literally and get kind of Popeyed and all. And obviously, as try as you might, you cannot force yourself to swallow every time I clap my hands. And that's because this, it's called a peristaltic wave. It's initiated right at your pharynx. It goes down your, your esophagus. It goes down to your esophagus into what's called the cardiac sphincter of your stomach. And the cardiac sphincter of your stomach is the reset switch. It goes up to the brain. Once that peristaltic wave hits the cardiac sphincter of your stomach, it causes a neural impulse to go up to your brain and say, okay, person is ready to swallow again. But until that peristaltic wave gets down there, you can't do anything to cause yourself to swallow again. And so that's the Creator's way of protecting us so that we don't get ahead of ourselves and it could really cause some gastronomic problems and perhaps, you know, possibly choking. And that's what happens sometimes. You choke a little bit because that whole sequence there gets short-circuited. So that's kind of fun. Now let's do some slit vision tracking. I don't know, I forgot to have some handouts there, so we'll have to use our hands. But when it comes to vision, remember I was talking about vision? And our vision is stereoscopic, isn't it? One half of what we see in the right eye goes to the left hand of the brain and from the left goes over to the right there, and it's kind of stereoscopic, so we get to see things in three dimensions, right? So what I want you to do is to, I want you to split your vision into two separate parts, so you're not seeing stereoscopically anymore. So let's look at the person sitting next to you. Look at the person next to you and put your hand like that so that you split your vision into two equal parts there, okay? Well, you got to push your hand out a little bit, so have it about the length of your thumb and put it on the end of your nose. Look at the person. Now wriggle the top of your fingers. Hey, we can have fun, can't we? I did that every year for 9 years at Pensacola Christian College. I would collapse on the floor because these cute little freshman girls are looking at each other going, Mr. Sherwin, what am I supposed to be saying? You know. Okay, well, we can have fun tonight. All right, what what about our lungs? Well, the lungs look like a pair of pink sponges. You know, they're not really huge, you know, bellows as we usually think of, but really they almost look like sponges, and they contain about 600 million tiny air sacs called alveoli. And this is why it's important not to smoke. You know, I'm not going to start preaching tonight. That's not my calling, but the alveoli have special muscles that surround them, and so every time you exhale, those muscles contract, and it helps to force the air out of the alveoli and get ready for the next breath. But when you inhale the tar and all the other junk and debris from cigarette smoke through the decades, that breaks down the muscles, and so a person through decades of smoking gets a chest that's called a what? A barrel chest, right? The problem for them is emphysema, where it's not getting a breath, it's getting rid of the breath. And so in other words, they have a whole bunch of air in there and they can't get rid of it. The muscle in the alveoli has been destroyed and they can't exhale properly. And when I was on the city fire department back in the early 1980s, there was occasions when we had to respond to people that were in a crisis mode where they couldn't exhale. And you feel for them because there's really nothing you can do except transport them to the emergency room. So 750 woven miles of blood vessels, and if you flatten down the lungs, please don't try that at home. If you flatten lungs out, they would cover about 1,000 square feet. So again, lungs very, very well designed for exchange of carbon dioxide and oxygen. What about the bone? Your bone is stronger than granite. You ever think about that? Your bone truly is stronger than granite. And by the way, your bone is very dynamic as well. People seem to think that bone is just something there and it's something kind of hang your muscles on and helps you to contract and all that. No, no, no. The bone is incredibly dynamic. And that's why, for example, linebackers can take a hit and so hard and just kind of get up and brush themselves off and go on their way. And if we were to take a hit like a typical NFL linebacker were to take a hit, it would kill us probably. But because they have been trained and they have so much muscle attached to their bone, it doesn't affect them very much. But the bone is extremely dynamic, very, very active. A block of bone half the size of a computer mouse can support 10 tons. Four times the capacity of concrete. In the adult, the marrow of the flat bones makes about 2.5 million red blood cells every second. So when you get to be about my age, a lot of the bone is no longer producing red blood cells. And that's a good question. Where are we getting all these red blood cells? They don't last very long because they don't have a nucleus. Red blood cells are designed to carry hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is designed to carry oxygen. So as you get older, less and less of your bones are producing red blood cells, except for the flat bones that I mentioned up there, and you're making millions every second, which also means what? Your body is taking in the old red blood cells at the same amount. 2.5 million red blood cells are being absorbed by your spleen and your liver every second. And so there's a lot of metabolic activity going on in the human body that we just take for granted, but it's very, very active, and bone is just unbelievable. Hey, by the way, speaking of bone, there's some breaking news. Sorry. In August, way back in 2007, scientists at Columbia University Medical College have discovered that the skeleton, get this, is also an endocrine organ controlling sugar metabolism and weight. The hormone osteoporin made by osteoblasts, and osteoblasts are actual bone cells, is a crucial hormone designed to interact with the beta cells of the pancreas. And I think we all remember from high school biology that the pancreas is very much involved with producing insulin and glucagon and helping to keep sugar levels within a tolerance and all that. But now, even in this 21st century, they're finding out some very, very basic information about the skeleton. Surprise, surprise, as that great American philosopher Gomer Pyle said, there's the skeleton now is also pretty much an endocrine organ. And as I like to ask my students at Pensacola Christian College, I always like to ask a lot of first aid questions. If you were to get your arm or leg broken in two places, what would you do? Answer, stop going to those places. Okay. Okay. Hey, we can have fun. And, of course, the heart. I like to talk about the heart. It beats at least 2.8 billion times during the average lifespan, and it rests between beats. And so let's do this tonight. Now, I understand some of you might have arthritis, and a dear Mennonite lady, elderly lady, I thought she was going to kill me because she took me literally, and she had arthritis, and she couldn't do it very well. But this is up north here. But anyway, what I want you to do is, with your right or left hand, I want you to do this, okay? I want you to squeeze kind of hard, just like a pump, okay? And as I talk for the next minute or two, please don't stop doing that. Just keep doing that, okay? So it rests between beats. During the time it pumps, 600,000 tons of blood through 60,000 miles of blood vessels. So there's a lot of blood moving through a lot of blood vessels. Keep going. If the skeletal or voluntary muscle tried to do what the heart does day out and day in, it would be useless within minutes, okay? Now, the muscles that are contracting your fingers in a pumping motion, okay, that is skeletal muscle, okay? And we take that for granted. But if you squeeze kind of hard each time, every second, you begin to find that, in fact, your hand gets tired. And we use our hands all the time. And yet our heart, thankfully, doesn't stop until the Lord decides, well, that's enough time for this individual. And so, okay, you can stop now. And people are going like this. But our heart muscle is really made of two different kinds of muscle, made of skeletal muscle and also involuntary muscle, what's also called smooth muscle, that is what our GI tract is all about. That's why when you get up early Sunday morning and you don't eat anything and you quickly go to church and Sunday school lesson and you're sitting there and that's a peristalsis of your GI tract, and you're sitting there in an empty stomach, and that's a peristaltic wave sounds that are being made there. So the Creator in His infinite wisdom has taken voluntary muscle, skeletal muscle, and involuntary muscle, smooth muscle, combine them into what's called cardiac muscle. And there's special sections of cardiac muscle called intercalated discs, which help to make a transmission of the wave of contraction of the heart. So it's, again, I think, very clear evidence for creation. Well, what about the origin of the immune system? I mentioned to you that a good parasitologist would have to be pretty much up on the immune system, because the invaders from the outside invade the individual, and so the immune system has to take care of that. Two evolutionists said just 10 years ago, there is still much debate on how the vertebrate immune system evolved. Okay, I think that's kind of interesting. And even less consensus on its relationship to the defense systems in invertebrates, that is, animals without a backbone. Now, this is a phrase, a quote that I want to park on a little bit, because it really does address this whole issue of origins, creation science versus evolutionism. These two evolutionists are dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist naturalists. They don't believe that in the beginning God created. And so they make the statement, there's still much debate on how the vertebrate immune system evolved. Well, guess what? There will always be much debate on how the vertebrate immune system evolved. Why? Because it didn't evolve. It was created, okay? And so they will forever be making statements like this, not only about the immune system, ladies and gentlemen, but all of the body systems, because none of it evolved. It was created, complete, fully formed, and functional by the Creator, and as David says in Psalm 139. So I thought it was kind of interesting that they would make this admission. I salute them for admitting in print what creationists have been saying all along. Well, I really can't end my talk this evening unless I just say one or two points in regard to human evolution, you know, the human body and the systems that were obviously designed. Let's look at what Ian Tattersall had to say a number of years ago. Ian Tattersall is a loose cannon on the deck, a paleontologist. He's not very popular with his evolutionary colleagues because he says things that every creationist knows, but Ian Tattersall at least is not afraid to say them in public. And so he talks about the story of human evolution, and it's the word that he uses, not me. He said the story starts with a bang, if for no better reason that there are no fossils that document humankind's initial and presumably painful descent from the trees. And so this is really an interesting quote. It's one of my favorite quotes that I use during debates with evolutionists, because Ian Tattersall is saying that there are just a few fossils. No, shake your head like this. He said, there are no fossils. None. Zero. Zip. Niet. Nada. There are no fossils that document humankind's initial and presumable painful. And we should not be surprised, because in the beginning, God created people as people, apes as apes, whales as whales, cows as cows. See how easy creation science is? Fish as fish, horses as horses. And so we would not expect, on the basis of the far superior scientific creation model, to all of a sudden be finding these so-called missing links. What have we been saying ever since Darwin? The missing links are missing. They're missing. They'll always be missing based on the creation model. And so this is a quote that I love to share. This is what Sylvia, is it Mader, I guess? Sylvia Mader said in her 1998 textbook, just about 9 years old. She said, therefore, it is, ooh, what's this word? It is believed that the last common ancestor betwixt the African apes and the hominids lived during the Pliocene epoch. Unfortunately, she said, this common ancestor has not yet been found. Ladies and gentlemen, on the basis of the creation science model, what can we say tonight as we draw to a close? They will never be found. Exactly right. They will never be found. Unfortunately, this common ancestor has not yet been found. on the basis of God's infallible, inerrant word that describes and discusses in infinite detail about our origin, not infinite, but the fact that it describes our origin, they will never find that critical missing link. For the evolutionists, unfortunately, they will continue to find human fossils, they'll find ape fossils, but they'll never find the common ancestor. And so I thought that was an interesting statement. I'm a fan of Tolstoy. My second daughter's name is Maria, and she's named after Princess Maria Bolkonsky in Tolstoy's War and Peace. But this is what Anne Gibbon said in 96. She said, "The story of human evolution has lately become as complicated as a Tolstoy novel." And I just have to laugh because I don't understand Tolstoy. I like to read it, but I certainly don't understand. It's kind of like Shakespeare, you know. But what an analogy to use to say that human evolution is as complicated as a Tolstoy novel. By the way, Tolstoy was at least as brilliant as Shakespeare, if not more brilliant. The guy was just absolutely amazing. But a wonderful analogy to use to describe this cryptic, mysterious process called human evolution. Well, once again, there's some breaking news. This goes back way back to August of 2007. More problems with the human evolution story. Once again, the chart showing the progression of ape-like creature to human. You've seen those, right? Back in my day when I was younger in high school, very, very popular diagram showing a smurf or something like that, and becoming an ape-like creature. and then, you know, a person and all that. But once again, the chart showing the progression has to be trashed and redrawn for the umpteenth time. How many times have they had to redraw that? Darwinists are now saying that Homo habilis and Homo erectus lived at the same time. When I was growing up, when I was in graduate school, University of Northern Colorado, I was taught that Homo habilis sired Homo erectus through the hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million and a half years. Now they're saying, whoops, looks like they lived at the same time. After stating for decades is what I've just described there. Human ape and DNA similarities, I really can't stop until I at least address this very, very quickly. First of all, this should be required memorization, this first sentence you see up there, for all students of biology. Genomes are not recipes. Genomes are a lot more sophisticated, a lot more detailed, but certainly they are not just recipes where you take a genome and poof, you'll get a snail or a person or whatever else. A creature that shares 98.4% of DNA with humans is not 98.4% human any more than a fish that shares, say, 40% is 40% human. There are fish off the coast of San Diego that have 40% the same DNA as people do. Does that mean that fish is 40% human? Not at all, not at all. That fish has to break down carbohydrates and proteins and fats just like people do, right? And so it's not surprising that the fish would have the same enzyme system. Respiration, same situation. Respiratory enzymes are very sophisticated. And myotomes are those muscular that helps the contraction of muscle. All of that has to be basically the same, so we shouldn't be surprised that 40% of DNA of fish and people would be the same. But the religious statement is to say that, well, we all have a common ancestor. We don't have a common ancestor. We have a common creator, a common designer. James Treffel is no friend of the creationist. He said that he was skeptical of arguments like those of the molecular biologist who talk about, you know, ape and human DNA being so similar. He said he's skeptical of arguments like those of the molecular biologist based on long strings of theoretical assumptions. And that's when you get at when you have molecular biology trying to make some kind of connection. But I save the best till last. As one evolutionist said a few years ago, we share half of our genes with the banana. And I forgot to bring a banana up with me. I usually do in my talks there. But yes, that's true. 50% of the genes of a banana and a person are the same. So is that person sitting next to you half banana? Yeah. And so this is why it's kind of silly to use that kind of line of argumentation. Well, there's so many other things that I want to share, but I don't have time. I like David Liberman for the same reason that I like Ian Tattersall. He said, the evolutionary history of humans is complex and unresolved. It now looks set to be thrown into further confusion. And that's the way the story of human evolution is, over and over again. And so to conclude tonight, I'd have to go along with the creation model, Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27, where it, Moses records in the first chapter of Genesis, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Okay.